Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, listeners. This is Military Monday, and I am your host, John Gresham. We are broadcasting today from beautiful Fairfax, Virginia, where spring has finally taken hold. There is green on the trees. There is fresh air full of pollen and eyes dripping from the allergies. And we're very glad to have you with us today. Today we're going to talk with an individual by the name of Stuart Goldman. Now, you probably have not heard his name before. He is the author of the book that is the subject of today's discussion. But it's that subject that is going to probably catch your interest more than anything. Just before the start of World War II, there was in the Far East, on the border between what we would today call Manchuria and Mongolia, a series of battles between Imperial Japan, their army and air force, and the Soviet Union. Now you say, hold it, I don't remember, you know, the Soviet Union getting into a fight with the Japanese until very close to the end of World War II. But in fact, the opening moves of World War II were in fact fought out on the plains near the town of Numenheim. The battles occurred during the spring and summer months, and the effects of these battles were huge, not only upon the Soviet Union and their subsequent relationship with Nazi Germany, but also with regard to the entry of Japan into World War II. So without further ado, we're going to go ahead and bring on our guest to talk about the battles of Numenheim. Hello, Stuart. Are you there?
I am here, John.
Okay. First of all, let's start with you, because you're an interesting guy in your own right.
Well,
what have you done in your life? What did you do for a living for all those years before you decided to go and, you know, actually write a book or two?
Well, I started out with a fairly conventional academic career, a PhD in history from Georgetown University. I focused especially on Russian and Soviet history. And I became a history professor, taught for a couple of years at Wilson College in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, and then for 7 years at Penn State. But I'm this improbable Russian specialist who actually speaks better Japanese than Russian. And my academic subspecialty was Soviet-Japanese relations. And I built a career around that. My wife and I are both from New York. We're big city kids. Central Pennsylvania did not do it for us. We moved back to Washington, D.C., and I was lucky enough to get a job at an outfit called the Congressional Research Service, which is just what the name sounds like. It's a research and analytical tank that works for the U.S. Congress. I became the principal Soviet political and military affairs analyst in the Foreign Affairs and National Defense Division of the Congressional Research Service. It was my job to write reports about what was going on in the Soviet Union, monitor U.S.-Soviet relations, brief members of Congress, travel with them to Moscow if they wanted my assistance, and so on. It was a great gig. I was there for 30 years, from 1979 to 2009. So think about that. 1979, Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and then the Reagan administration, and the most intense part of the end of the Cold War, and then Gorbachev, and Glasnost, and Perestroika, and the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the collapse of the Soviet Union, and then Yeltsin, and finally Putin. And I was there in the middle of all of that. It was phenomenal. It was a roller coaster ride. It was the experience of a lifetime.
And you worked with some of the finest academics, frankly, inside the Beltway. I mean, we were discussing the other day the great Marcia Smith, who has been just outstanding in her work at CRS regarding space programs was one of your colleagues. This is a great outfit to work for in this town.
It is indeed. It was literally the best job in town for someone of my temperament. I was lucky to get it, and I'd like to think I made the most of it.
Well, good.
However, after 30 years in the harness, by my mid-1960s, I decided it was time to move on, retired from government service, and reverted to my earlier intellectual identity as an historian, and picked up the threads of this Soviet-Japanese story that had been with me really since my graduate school days, and had in fact been the subject of my doctoral dissertation. And to my surprise, other scholars had not jumped on the lead that I provided in that doctoral dissertation. And so I was lucky enough to get the U.S. Naval Institute Press to agree to publish a book on that subject, and that's where this book, Nomenhan 1939, came from. The half title is The Red Army's Victory That Shaped World War II.
Now, let me ask you this. 40 years ago, you wrote a doctoral thesis about this, right?
Yes.
And is the book essentially a rewrite of your thesis, or did you use the thesis as the basis for the book and then start it again from scratch?
The latter. After I was already teaching at Penn State, I was lucky enough to be awarded a one-year postdoctoral research fellowship by the Japan Foundation, which allowed me to spend a year living in Tokyo, studying the Japanese language, doing more research on this subject. And the book, which grew out of that research and more recent research that I've done, it goes far beyond what I was able to put into the doctoral dissertation. At the time that I wrote the dissertation, I couldn't read or speak a word of Japanese. In fact, I didn't even know the name of the principal Japanese protagonist in this story at that time, because I had it from English language and Russian language sources.
Okay. So you make up your mind to go and write really the first definitive English history of this battle. I mean, I have read bits and pieces about it in various sources, but generally it's pretty much, you know, a paragraph here, a paragraph there. What was your objective when you sat down to actually write this particular book?
Well, let me start off by backing up a little bit. There is actually one other big book in English that deals with this Soviet-Japanese conflict. It was written in 1985 by a guy named Alvin Kooks at University of California, San Diego. But Kooks was a Japan specialist, and his book is an exhaustive military history of the battle told exclusively from the Japanese point of view and down to small unit-level combat. And really has nothing at all to say about the larger historical context and the geostrategic consequences of this conflict. My book is much shorter than his, and is really a kind of a two-headed monster. Half of it is a history of this little-known battle, and the other half is the diplomatic and geostrategic context and why this seemingly obscure East Asian military episode really was a key factor in the outbreak of the Second World War in Europe. So I connected the dots. And that part of the story which I provided, I've broken new ground with that.
And without further ado, let's go talk about the battles of Nomenhan in 1939. And let's start out by saying this is actually not a single battle. It's a series of battles over the spring and late from spring until late summer 1939. And it doesn't even go by the same name all around the area.
Right, you are. That's right. The Japanese call it Nomenhan Jiken, the Nomenhan Incident. In Russia and Mongolia, it's known as Boyu Khalkhin Gol, the Battle of Khalkhin Gol. And as you correctly say, it wasn't a single set-piece battle. It was actually, John, a small undeclared war. A couple hundred thousand men, 1,000 tanks, 1,000 aircraft, 30 to 50,000 men killed and wounded in 4 months of intense combat. This is big-time combat. The fighting reaches climax at the end of August 1939, coinciding precisely with the conclusion of the German-Soviet non-aggression pact, August 23rd, 1939, which was Hitler's green light to invade Poland, which sparked the outbreak of the Second World War 1 week later. And so the story that I'm laying out links together this East Asian conflict and these European developments and the outbreak of the war.
Let's start at the beginning. What caused the Japanese and the Russians to get into this dust-up in the first place in early 39?
In 1931, Japan seized Manchuria from China. China had entered into a period of what we call end-of-dynasty syndrome in the early 20th century. The Manchu dynasty came to an end. Civil war, warlordism, China was falling apart at the seams. The Japanese took advantage of that opportunity to grab this big northeastern part of China that we know as Manchuria. When Japan acquires Manchuria, it acquires a 3,000-mile-long border with the Soviet Far East and with Mongolia. At that time, the Mongolian People's Republic, the only other communist country in the world. And much of this border was poorly demarcated, and so it was ripe for border disputes and border clashes and border conflicts. And there were over 1,000 such disputes over the years. But by far the biggest one is this Nomonhan incident in 1939.
Now, it's worth noting at this point in world history, neither Imperial Japan or the Soviet Union were particularly good neighbors to anybody, much less to each other.
Correct.
Who was in charge of these countries at that point, and what were their respective policies towards neighbors?
That's a good question. Stalin, in the late 1930s, Stalin is the master of the Soviet Union, the undisputed, total totalitarian dictator. And by 1939, what has evolved in Japan is almost a full-blown military dictatorship. In fact, the two countries are almost mirror images, almost caricatures of the two most extreme possibilities in terms of civil-military relations. By 1939, Stalin had purged the Red Army leadership and was slaughtering the officer corps of the Red Army, whereas in Japan, it was the exact opposite. The military had taken control and were assassinating political leaders who didn't want to go along with them. And so we have these two extreme representations of the way civilian and military leadership works. But then in the larger global context, by 1939, it was apparent that the world was sliding toward war. And you could think of the world as divided into three big blocks. There were the fascist militarist bloc, Germany, Italy, and Japan. There was the bourgeois democratic bloc, England and France, maybe the United States if it would recover from the hangover of isolationism growing from the disillusionment with the First World War. And the third bloc is the Soviet Union. Well, it's just a single country, but it's just a big country. Of those three blocs, the Soviet Union is the weakest militarily. And each of these three is suspicious of and hostile toward the other two. So it's what physicists would call a three-body problem. And there comes to be a lot of maneuvering among the three of them as Europe and Asia are moving toward war.
Now, Japan has already created and is engaged in a full-blown war with China and the forces under check. At the same time, they decide, okay, let's go ahead and take a swing at the Soviet Union. This is not, you know, as Hitler, Napoleon, and a few other people have found, this is not a prescription for success.
You would think so. You would think so. And part of what's going on here is that the Japanese military is getting out of control. And what led Japan into this small underpaid war with the Soviet Union was not some plot that was hatched in Tokyo. It was the result of some hot-headed, field-grade Japanese Army officers in the Japanese Army of Occupation in Manchuria. And precisely because, beginning in 1937, Japan is engaged in an all-out war in China. Now, the Japanese army in Manchuria, called the Kwantung Army, they're sitting on the sidelines, and they want to be in the action. Well, the only action they can be in is against the Russians. So that's part of the story. But the other piece of the action is this: Hitler has seized control in Germany and is expanding eastward. We have the Anschluss with Austria, and then the seizure of Czechoslovakia, and then it's apparent that the next item on Hitler's agenda is Poland, making noises about Danzig and the Polish corridor. At the same time that the Japanese are expanding in China and have moved into Manchuria and are threatening to move north and west from their base in Manchuria. And so Stalin is seeing the clear and present danger of a possible two-front war with the Germans in the west and the Japanese in the east. And this is not just some idle threat. Japan and Germany were already allies based on the 1936 Anti-Comintern Pact. So that's the background for this conflict that arises beginning in May 1939. But again, The provocation of this fight was not a decision in Tokyo to go take a swipe at the Soviet Union. It was hot-headed majors and lieutenant colonels in Manchuria who were determined to put on to be tough vis-a-vis the Soviet Union over an obscure border dispute.
Now, talk a little bit about the real estate that they were fighting over around the area of Neumannhahn. What kind of terrain, what kind of resources, what was it all about?
I wish I could put a map up on the screen for our listeners to see. Mongolia is this gigantic country. It's much bigger than Texas. And it's in Inner Asia. It has no outlet to the sea. Mongolia projects a salient. It kind of pokes a finger eastward into the side of Manchuria, which is northeastern China. And at the very tip of that salient, the very tip of that finger that's poking into the belly of Manchuria, so to speak, that's where there was a dispute over the border. There was a river that ran through, this is high desert. It's semi-arid sand and loose sand and grassland. It's like the worst parts of the Texas Panhandle and North Dakota. It's open country. It's tank country. It's very, very sparsely populated. There are no important natural resources there to speak of. There were none there in 1939. Even today, there are no important natural resources there. It is desolate country. I have walked that land in summer and winter, and it is hostile. It is very, very difficult terrain. It is hot as hell in the summer and bitterly freezing cold in the winter. It's what geographers call an extreme continental climate. In the summer, the temperatures climb up to 110 degrees. In the winter, I was there 3 years ago in January, and at noontime it warmed up to 25 below zero Fahrenheit. That's the kind of place it is.
In short, it sucked.
Yeah, and so they weren't fighting over some rich land that both wanted. They were fighting, it was a question of pride. It was a question of each side is determined to defend a borderline as they defined it. And the actual fighting began in early May. And we know very well why the fighting began. Because on the 25th of April, the Japanese army in Manchuria established new guidelines for Japanese troops on the borders in order to enforce the border. It's actually Kwantung Army Operations Order Number 1488. Let me read a little bit of this. This is a direct quote. And this is Kwantung Army Headquarters, Japanese Army Headquarters, giving instructions to their troop commanders on the border. Quote, "It is permissible to enter Soviet territory or to trap or lure Soviet troops into Manchurian territory. Where borders are unclear, local commanders will establish boundaries. In the event of an armed clash, fight on to victory, regardless of the location of boundaries. Consequences will be the responsibility of higher headquarters," end quote. That's April 25th. What a surprise. A couple of weeks later, another one of these obscure little border skirmishes occur, only this one blows up into a small underclass war because it's triggered by this Japanese army order. And this order is written by a major in the operations section of the Japanese Kwantung Army, a guy named Tsuji, T-S-U-J-I. And he will become the principal Japanese protagonist in this fight.
Okay, so the Japanese have whipped their mid-grade officers in the area into a bit of a frenzy. And with this operational order, it's clearly obvious that nobody's going to get mad at them if they start shooting at some Russians in the neighborhood.
They start shooting not at some Russians, but at some Mongolian cavalry that cross over the river. And the Japanese insist that this river, the Halha River, is the boundary. The Russians and the Mongolians say, no, the boundary is actually some 10 or 12 miles east of that river. And so the land between the river and the Soviet-Mongolian claim boundary east of the river is in dispute. It's a stretch of land 10 to 12 miles wide, about 40 miles long from north to south, and this is the land that they're fighting over. And the fighting begins in mid-May when the Japanese general who's commanding the forces on this part of the border sends an infantry regiment to crush the Mongolian invaders in keeping with this new order that he's just received. And he expects that he's going to be dealing with a handful of Mongolian light cavalry. But the Soviets see the Japanese coming, and the Soviet Union has a military alliance with Mongolia and is pledged to defend Mongolia, and the Soviets send a mechanized infantry regiment to the battle scene. And there's a big battle on May 28th to May 29th. And the Japanese are taken by surprise by the more powerful Soviet forces there and suffer serious losses. A whole reconnaissance regiment is wiped out. And the Japanese are licking their wounds. And this guy, Tsuji, back at Kwantung Army headquarters, decides that this cannot be allowed to stand. And so he draws up plans which he and his buddies in the operations section sell to the three-star generals, who are the commanders of the Kwantung Army, that they're going to launch a big counterattack. They're going to, in division strength, they're going to send 10,000 men across the river into Mongolia and crush the Mongolians and Soviets and teach them a lesson. And so there's another big battle in July. Only in June, the Soviets get wind that the Japanese are building up their forces. And so Moscow, Stalin, decides to send big reinforcements out to the borderland. And even though he's busy purging the heck out of the army and slaughtering the best of his commanders left and right, he hasn't killed all the good ones. And as luck would have it, the guy who gets sent out to command the Soviet forces on this disputed battle is a young tank commander named Georgi Zhukov. Zhukov,
now,
of course,
before
is the
you go
guy,
any further, let's just say this is an officer who would have a career unlike anybody in the Russian army since Field Marshal Kutuzov during the War of 1812, although he was obviously just a shiny Kopech back in 1939.
That's right. Zhukov, of course, goes on to command the Red Army in the war against Germany in the Second World War. He became, for the Red Army, Dwight Eisenhower and Douglas MacArthur all rolled into one. But this was his first major combat command, and this is where he won his spurs against the Japanese at what the Russians call the Battle of Khalkhin-Gol in mid-1939. So Zhukov gets sent out there, and he gets powerful reinforcements. Thousands of men and artillery, but most important, hundreds of tanks and armored cars. When I first started reading, and armored cars figure prominently in this action. When I first started reading about armored cars, I had this picture in my mind of something like a 1930s version of a Brinks or Wells Fargo truck that would carry money to the bank. But Soviet armored cars in the 1930s were serious armored fighting vehicles. They had the turret and the 45-millimeter high-velocity cannon of a medium tank. And on top of that, Zhukov also got several hundred tanks. And the Japanese just did not have the armor that could cope with Zhukov. And as I said, the terrain that they were fighting over is tank country. And Zhukov knew tanks. And so the Japanese launched
there was a significant contingent of the Russian frontal aviation forces as well. Lots of fighters and bombers and actually outnumbered the Japanese in this manner.
That both the Soviets and the Japanese brought hundreds and hundreds of aircraft to the front, and there were huge air battles. And hundreds of planes were shot down on both sides. It was very, very major air combat and ground combat. It was so far from the sea that there are no naval forces involved. So the Japanese launched this big counteroffensive in the first days of July. And in the early going, they're quite successful. They actually catch Zhukov by surprise. But Zhukov is able to throw his tanks in to blunt the Japanese advance. And the Japanese cannot cope with Soviet honor, and they are thrown back. Both sides suffer very heavy losses, thousands and thousands of men killed on both sides. Zhukov loses several hundred tanks and armored cars in this battle. But the result is that the Japanese are forced to retreat and again are humiliated. But Zhukov concludes that the Japanese are going to keep escalating this thing. And so he sends word back to Moscow asking for still more reinforcements. And Stalin decides to give him what he wants. And so by late July, early August, Zhukov is sitting on the equivalent of four infantry divisions, over 500 tanks, over 500 aircraft, hundreds of heavy artillery pieces, and he's ready to launch a counterstrike and wipe out the Japanese. But Stalin says, hey, not so fast, not so fast. It's now early August 1939. And Europe is about to plunge into war. Hitler is moving east. And Stalin is not sure whether or not he might be involved in this war in the east. He doesn't want to be fighting the Germans and have a big fight on his hands with the Japanese. But the most important spy in the whole Second World War was a Soviet military intelligence officer named Richard Sorge, who was based in Tokyo. And he had very high-level access to the German embassy in Tokyo. And Sorge's most important Japanese agent worked in the office of the Japanese prime minister and was able to give Sorge terrific first-hand information on what the Japanese government was thinking. And Sorge was able to assure Stalin that the Japanese government had no intention of waging war against the Soviet Union in 1939, and that emboldened Stalin to go forward with his plans. At the same time, Stalin concludes an alliance with Hitler, the German-Soviet Non-Aggression Pact. And when Stalin signs this pact with Hitler, he then gives Zhukov the green light to unleash his operation against the Japanese. And on the 20th of August, Zhukov launches a huge counterattack in which the Japanese are surrounded and annihilated. It was a battle of annihilation, John. When we say that an army has been decimated, that means literally decimated. They lost 1 in 10. The Japanese frontline troops at No Man's Land suffered 75% killed in combat. It was a battle of annihilation because Zhukov had a chance to employ what would become his signature tactic that he used in the Battle of Moscow and the Battle of Stalingrad and the Battle of Kursk, in which he concentrated his armor on the flanks and surrounded the enemy and forged a steel ring of armor around it and impounded them and ground them into the dust. That's how this Battle of No Man's Land ended late August, early September 1939, with the total annihilation of the Japanese forces.
I'd like to talk more about the collateral effect of what you just described, as well as the contextual outcomes. But we're going to take a quick break and do a couple of network messages. And when we get back, we'll talk about the outcomes and results of the Battle of No Man's
Land. Very good.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter @RightStream and #RightStream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the Right Stream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com. That's LISATARVES. For details on all the services I offer, information on my book and my radio show, there are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for Right Stream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. Right Stream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. Right Stream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network.
And welcome back. This is Military Monday, and I am your host, John Gresham. And are you still with us there, Stuart?
I am indeed.
Stuart, you described, almost in passing, as you were describing the end of the combat phase of the battles of No Man's Land, the fact that all of a sudden, towards the end, there was this sudden flurry of diplomacy that came out of Moscow. And it went two directions. One was the famous Nazi-Soviet peace pact that made it possible to go ahead and for Hitler to invade Poland, knowing he was not going to have a combat relationship with Stalin. And at the same time, there was a diplomatic effort with the Japanese to go ahead and bring some sanity back to what was going on out in the Far East near Numenheim. Can you break those two initiatives down and how they kind of developed and went in the late summer of 1939?
Absolutely. And to do that, I want to back up a little bit further. And let's take a closer look at what's going on in Europe. And let's go to September 1938 and the Munich Agreement, in which the British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain betrays Czechoslovakia and sells Czechoslovakia out to Hitler in order to win what he called peace in our time. This of course is the high water mark of British appeasement of Hitler and of Nazi Germany. And you've all seen the pictures: Chamberlain flying back to London, umbrella in hand, peace in our time. Hitler promised Chamberlain that if you satisfy me by giving me this chunk of Czechoslovakia, the Sudetenland, which is inhabited by 3.5 million ethnic Germans, that's my last territorial demand in Europe. You won't hear from me again. Everything will be cool after that. But 6 months later,
in other words, he said, "Trust me."
Yeah. And then exactly 6 months later, Hitler tore up the Munich Agreement and invaded the rest of Czechoslovakia and took Czechoslovakia over. Chamberlain was not only furious, he was humiliated because he had staked his career on appeasement. And by this act, Hitler showed that appeasement didn't work, that his appetite grew with the eating. It was very evident that the next item on his menu was Poland. And so Chamberlain abandoned appeasement and did this very uncharacteristic thing. He offered an unconditional guarantee to Poland. He said, if Germany attacks Poland, England will fight. And France went along. And so the British and French are now on the line to fight against Germany in the event of a German attack on Poland. Well, Hitler was confident they could handle Poland. He hoped that he'd be able to frighten England and France into backing down yet again, as they had backed down time and time again in the 1930s. But if they didn't, he was pretty sure that he could deal with England and France too. However, Hitler did not want to repeat the German mistake of 1914 and have to fight England and France and Russia simultaneously. And so when the British and French give this guarantee to Poland saying, we will fight to defend Poland, this suddenly presents Hitler with the danger of a possible two-front war, England and France in the west and Soviet Russia in the east. And so the Germans start looking at the Soviet Union with interest, and this puts powerful cards in Stalin's hands. Because up until now, the Soviet Union was diplomatically isolated. But when Chamberlain decides he may have to fight Germany, even though Chamberlain distrusts Stalin and detests the Soviet Union, he figures, if I actually have to fight the Germans, it sure would be convenient to have Russia as an ally. And so the British and French start talking to Stalin about some kind of Anglo-French-Soviet military alliance against Germany. At the same time, Stalin then turns and starts talking to Hitler. Because Hitler knows that he's going to fight Poland. He may have to fight the British and French. He doesn't want to have to fight the Russians, too. And so there comes to be very serious negotiations, secret negotiations, between Berlin and Moscow. So by mid-1939, what you've got is a situation in which the British and French and the Germans are both looking to cut a deal with the Soviet Union.
Now,
right here, John, this is where the Japanese launched their aggression at Numenheim. And so all these threads come together in the summer of 1939.
Now, let's put a little context on the table here, because we love context, since we're historians. At this point in world history, Joseph Stalin is not exactly the most popular guy on the block. He's already murdered and committed genocide against millions of his own people during the Great Terror. He has essentially gone and lopped off the head of his officer corps in his military. He is arguably one of the most paranoid, masochistic, and deeply, deeply twisted individuals on planet Earth at this point. And all of a sudden, everybody's coddling up to him and giving him diplomatic options?
Yeah, because he happens to be the leader of the Soviet Union, and there's going to be a war. And whose side the Soviet Union is on in this coming war is rather important. And so the British and French would like to have Russia as an ally, and Germany would like to have Russia not as an enemy. And so even though Stalin, as you put it, is something less than the most popular kid on the block, he's holding high cards because Chamberlain put those cards in his hand by giving this guarantee to Poland. And so suddenly the Soviet Union is rather important.
Okay, so what does Stalin choose to do?
Well, we know, of course, he's in a position, he can sign up with the British and French to resist Germany, or he can sign up with Hitler. And, of course, we know the decision that he makes. He signs up with Hitler. And there are many reasons for that. And I am confident that the most important reason was by signing the pact with Hitler, he sets up a conflict between Germany and England and France in which the Soviet Union is sitting on the sidelines. Well, I mean, frankly, even though this Hitler-Stalin pact was condemned as the most cynical and treacherous diplomatic event of the century, the fact is, if you, John, were responsible for Soviet foreign policy in 1939, and you had a chance to have your bourgeois capitalist enemies and your fascist militarist capitalist enemies fight each other, wouldn't that be the ideal outcome? Of course it would. And
of course,
and that's what Stalin set up. But there's another factor. The other factor is Stalin has this Japanese problem. If Stalin decides to sign an anti-fascist alliance with Britain and France, he probably has to fight Germany. At the very least, he has to mobilize the Red Army in the West against Germany, which invites further Japanese aggression in the East. On the other hand, if Stalin signs up with Hitler, not only do the British and French fight the Germans and leave him out of it in Europe, but Stalin separates Japan from Japan's ally, Germany. It isolates Japan and allows Stalin to turn around and smash the Japanese at Nomonhan, which is exactly what he did. And it's perfectly apparent, even in the German diplomatic documents that were published just 3 years after the war ended in 1948. One of the things that happens when you lose a war is the other guys capture your archives and throw them open. And the German diplomatic documents show in the meetings between the German ambassador in Moscow, called von der Schulenburg, and the Soviet foreign minister, Molotov. Four times in August 1939, the German ambassador asks Molotov, "What is it that you want? What do we Germans need to do in order to get the agreement that we're hoping for?" And four times Molotov gives him a list of what the Soviet Union requires of Germany. And each time, the very first item on Molotov's list is that Germany must use its good offices to get the damn Japanese to cease and desist from their aggression in Mongolia. Four times, that's what heads the list. It's perfectly obvious that Stalin was worried about this Japanese problem, and that if there's going to be a war in Europe, he doesn't want to have to fight the Germans and the Japanese at the same time. And that's where I come at this story.
Now, in addition, as almost a side benefit, Stalin picks up half of Poland all the way to the River Bug, as well as the Baltic states, Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia. In other words, he gets a little buffer zone and some room, which, of course, winds up being the difference a couple years later when Hitler initiates Operation Barbarossa, the Great Patriotic War. So
let me make this really clear. I am no great fan of Joseph Stalin. I detest Stalin. I think he's one of the greatest monsters in modern history. However, up to this point, September 1939, I grudgingly give Stalin very high marks for his clever conduct of diplomacy up to this point. I believe that Stalin believed that 1939 was going to be something like 1914, that England and France and Germany would be more or less evenly balanced, that they would bleed each other white as they had in the First World War. And after a year or two or three of that, the Soviet Union would be able to step in on one side or the other and be the master of Europe. Well, of course, it didn't turn out that way. Who could have predicted in the summer of 1939 that France would collapse a year later more rapidly than Poland had? And that Germany would become this colossus that bestrides the continent and threatens the Soviet Union. Stalin didn't anticipate that. Nobody anticipated that in 1939. But imagine that you're holding a TV remote control now. And fast forward 2 years. It's now the summer of 1941. And Germany has just invaded the Soviet Union, Operation Barbarossa. And as you know, in the early going, in the first months of that war, the German army had such phenomenal success, and the Red Army suffered such catastrophic losses, it looked like the Red Army was on the verge of collapse. The German army plunged more deeply into Soviet Russia in 4 months in 1941 than the Imperial German Army had in 4 years from 1914 to 1918 against an ineptly led and poorly equipped Tsarist Russian army. It looked like the Russians were on the ropes. And right after his invasion of the Soviet Union, Hitler turns to the Japanese, John. And Hitler says, okay, here's your chance, Tokyo. Here's your chance to attack the Soviet Far East. Get even for that beating the Russians laid on you 2 years ago. Take the whole Soviet Far East. I don't need it. I can't reach it. It's yours for the taking. But do it now. 6 months from now, I won't need you. The war will be over. And in the summer of 1941, when it looked like Germany had everything going their way, France had been defeated, all of Western Europe was under Nazi control, England was fighting for its life, and now it looked like the Red Army was about to collapse, a lot of the Japanese army guys found this German appeal very appealing. And they were very interested in throwing in with the Germans against the Soviet Union. However, at that same moment, in July 1941, the Roosevelt administration has just imposed an oil embargo on Japan.
Not just oil, but scrap iron as well.
Yeah, but the oil was the critical thing because Japan had almost no domestic sources of petroleum. And virtually all the oil in the world that Japan had access to was controlled by the United States and Britain and our friends and allies. Who exported oil in 1941? Canada, United States, Mexico, Venezuela, some British colonies in the Persian Gulf, Russian oil in Baku, which the Japanese couldn't get, Romanian oil in Ploiesti, which the Japanese couldn't get. Without oil, the whole Japanese war machine and their war in China would grind to a halt in 6 months. Oh, yeah, there was one other place where there was oil. modern-day Indonesia, the Dutch East Indies, was already a major oil producer and exporter. The Netherlands was already conquered by Germany. There's a handful of Dutch colonial troops in the East Indies minding the store. The Japanese know that they can get that oil and solve their oil embargo problem. But they believe that if they make a grab for this Dutch oil, they will wind up having to fight the United States. And so in July, August, September 1941, there is what Japanese historians call a series of imperial war conferences. There's a great debate in Tokyo. And this is an oversimplification, but in substantial part, it was an Army versus Navy debate. The Navy wanted that oil, which meant war with America. A lot of the Army guys want to go fight the Russians and fog in with Germany. And they're debating this. And again, this most important spy in the Second World War, our friend Richard Sorge in Tokyo, is able to inform Moscow in September, October 1941 that the Japanese have now made an irrevocable decision to strike south, which means ultimately that's what takes them to Pearl Harbor. And that's what the underlying reason was for the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, to neutralize the American Pacific Fleet so it could grab that oil. But Sorge tells Moscow that the Japanese will not attack the Soviet Union this year. And that's what gives Stalin the ability to transfer his Far Eastern reserves from the Soviet Far East, where he's got hundreds of thousands of troops and thousands of tanks and airplanes on guard against a possible Japanese attack, and to ship them west across the Trans-Siberian Railroad to the Moscow front.
By the way, is going west to go and command all these troops.
And there's our friend Georgi Zhukov, who, having proved his mettle at Nomadan, or Khalkhin Gol, 2 years earlier, has now been entrusted by Stalin with the defense of Moscow. You know, a lot of people imagine that the most decisive battle, the most important battle in this war in Europe, was the Battle of Stalingrad. But actually, many scholars and military history experts, including me, believe that the real most decisive battle was a year earlier at Moscow, because that's when Germany came closest to breaking the back of the Red Army. And Stalin made a decision to stand and fight at Moscow, unlike Tsar Alexander I in 1812, who surrendered Moscow to Napoleon. But Stalin said, not just we're going to make a fight of it, we will hold Moscow at all costs. And so it became the critical point. And because Stalin is able to transfer the Far Eastern reserves to the Moscow front in October and November, hundreds of thousands of troops, 17 infantry divisions, 1,500 tanks, 1,700 aircraft get shifted from the Soviet Far East to the Moscow front. These are the troops that Zhukov uses to launch the counteroffensive, which pushes the Russians back, pushes the Germans back from the gates of Moscow. The advanced German units were so close to capturing Moscow that their reconnaissance units could actually see the spires of the Kremlin in their binoculars. They were within 20 miles of the Kremlin. That's how close they got. And in the first week of December, on the 6th of December, 1941, Zhukov launches a massive counterattack using his Far Eastern forces and using the same tactics that he used against the Japanese at Khalkhin Gol, at Nomadan. And he throws the Germans back 1 to 200 miles back from Moscow and holds them there through the rest of the winter. And that counterattack begins on the 6th of December, 1941. 1 day later, Japan attacks Pearl Harbor. The United States declares war on Japan. Germany stupidly and gratuitously declares war on the United States. I don't know how Roosevelt gets Congress to declare war on Germany because Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. But Hitler solved that problem for him by declaring war on the United States. And so we declare war on Germany. And this is the most critical week in the entire Second World War. It's the week that the United States entered the war. It's the week that Zhukov threw the Germans back from Moscow and saved the Soviet Union from defeat. It's the week that doomed the Axis.
It is said by more than a few people who apparently were there that after Churchill talked on the phone to Roosevelt that evening, he went outside and just gave a personal cheer and then slept the sleep of a man who knew he was not going to lose World War II, that Britain was going to win.
That Britain was no longer standing alone. That's right. That's right. But, John, what if things had turned out? Suppose there had been no Soviet-Japanese undeclared war at Nomonhan in 1939. Suppose the Japanese did not have this very, very healthy respect for Soviet military capability. And I should add, in the deliberations in Tokyo in the summer of 1941, which led to the Japanese decision for war with America. And, you know, this is an important piece of the story that I should have brought in a few minutes ago. In this Army versus Navy debate over striking north against Russia or striking south against the United States, I have it from Japanese, from very high-level Japanese sources, that one of the most influential Army voices who sided with the Navy position in this debate was the same guy, Tsuji, who was instrumental at Nomonhan. And here he is in 1941, the head of the operations section at Imperial General Headquarters in Tokyo. He's this very charismatic, outspoken, uncharacteristic, kind of un-Japanese Japanese guy, very out front, very influential. And he stands up and he argues, "I have experienced Soviet firepower firsthand. You don't want to go there again." And I have it from Japanese sources that he was very influential in the Japanese decision to strike south. I am not trying to say that because of Nomonhan, that's what made the Japanese attack Pearl Harbor. That's too simple, and it's not correct. The Japanese thirst for oil was terrifically important. But Japanese historians almost unanimously agree that because of their experience of fighting the Russians in 1939, they decided that they didn't want to try their hand at that a second time around. And so for sure, that was one of the factors that influenced Japanese decision in 1941. But suppose there had been no Battle of Nomonhan. Suppose the Japanese didn't have this heightened respect for Soviet military capability. Suppose Japan had thrown in with Germany and attacked the Soviet Far East in October 1941. There are many military history experts, including people who I know personally, who are on the staff of the Academy of Military History of the Russian Academy of Sciences, who will argue that the Soviet Union could not have survived a two-front war in 1941 to 1942. It wouldn't have been necessary for Japan to defeat the Soviet Union. It might have been quite sufficient for Japan to have opened up a big front, which would have prevented Stalin from transferring the Far Eastern reserves to the Moscow front. If the Soviet Union could not have survived a two-front war in 1941 to 42, that means the Soviet Union would have been defeated. If the Soviet Union were defeated in 1941 to 1942, how do you defeat Germany? It's arguable, John.
It is a
John,
very hard thing at that point. And,
it's arguable that the whole continent of Europe would be speaking German today instead of English. And that's rather a hypothetical point. And I don't necessarily want to go that far. But let me say simply that the Battle of Nomonhan in 1939 cast a long shadow and influenced critically important decisions in 1939 that triggered the outbreak of the war in Europe and in 1941 that helped shape the conduct and ultimately the outcome of that war.
Which raises one final question and the last one I'm going to ask you today. Why doesn't Nomonhan have a greater reputation? Why is it not better known here in America? I mean, let's not kid ourselves. Americans are so ill-informed about their own history, it's hard to go ahead and beat on them for not knowing a little bit more about Russian and Japanese history. But that said, one would think within the circle of military scholarship, Nomonhan would be one of those battles which gets covered a lot more than it is. What are your thoughts on this?
That's a very good question, John. And part of the answer is that that the fighting took place in as obscure and remote a godforsaken a place as you could possibly imagine. There just weren't a lot of journalists or diplomats or observers out there to write about what was going on. But also, in the summer of 1939, people who focus on military stuff, they will focus on Poland and the looming war in Europe. And also, both the Soviet side and the Japanese side kept the fighting quiet. The Japanese kept it quiet. Of course, they got thrashed. The Soviets kept it quiet because this fight with the Japanese was an embarrassment to Soviet diplomacy in trying to sidle up to Germany, because Germany and Japan were allies. And so Stalin didn't want to give either the Germans or the British and French the notion that he had this big Japanese problem that he might not be able to handle, because he was playing this clever diplomatic game, playing off Britain and France against Germany. And so Stalin, too, kept the fighting quiet. And when the fighting finally ended, at the very end of August and the beginning of September 1939, Hitler invades Poland, and everyone's attention is focused on the war in Europe. And so this fight gets buried. There have been lots of books written about the battle itself in Russian, in the Russian language, and in the Japanese language. But Japanese historians who write about this in Japanese, they're not interested in possible spillover effects in Europe, and none of the Japanese historians write about the implications of this fight for the outbreak of the war in Europe. And in the Soviet Union, the German-Soviet Non-Aggression Pact was a radioactive subject. An alliance between Hitler and Stalin was so shameful that Soviet scholars did not want to write about it. And even today, more than 20 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russian scholarship today still is making excuses for Stalin's alliance with Hitler. And it's a subject that they don't like to talk about. And you know, Americans don't read Japanese and Russian history books. But when you look in the standard histories that have been written in the United States and in Britain and in Western Europe about the origins of the Second World War, this Soviet-Japanese conflict is a black hole. And I'm lucky enough to have been the guy who fills in that blank space. And so what I've done in this book, John, is to put into place a small piece and a very important jigsaw puzzle. The jigsaw puzzle is the origins of the Second World War. And I'm saying, when you consider the Soviet-Japanese conflict and put that piece into place in the jigsaw puzzle, the whole puzzle makes more sense. And that's what this book is about. And I'm pleased to say that it's getting the recognition even beyond what I had dared hope. I mean, the book is selling well.
As I recall, you mentioned that you've been nominated for an award with this book.
Yeah, and not only is the book selling well, it's been published in Japanese already. There'll be a Chinese edition soon. There's a U.S. Commission on Military History, which gives an annual award for the Book of the Year in Military History. And I've been honored to have my book nominated for that Book of the Year award. The award hasn't been given out for the year which my book was published. And I don't know if it will win. My guess is there are lots of other good books. Maybe my book is even a long shot. But even to be nominated for Book of the Year in Military History is a big deal. I am just tickled pink.
Well, we appreciate you coming on and talking to us today. It's been a lot of fun. And while I never get accused of trying to find more obscure battles and stories to tell, I think that this particular little obscure battle is more than worth the hour we've put into it. Stuart, I want to thank you for coming on today. I hope you'll continue writing. And next time you get something published, give me a call, because we'd love to have you back on.
I would be glad to do that. I'll just remind your listeners, It's Nomenhan, 1939, U.S. Naval Institute Press. You can find it on Amazon.com. It's available in paperback. It's out as an audio book. End of plug.
It's a good book. I really enjoyed my time. I'm on deadline for an annual that I go and do every year, and this was my relaxation reading this weekend when I needed to get my mind off of special operations. So thank you so much for coming, and I hope we get to see you again sometime soon.
Thank you very much, John. It's been my pleasure. Bye-bye.
Take care. And with that, listeners, we come to the end of another edition of Military Monday. I hope you'll continue to be with us in the weeks ahead. We have planned in May and June a month of Midway. We're going to do a series of shows all dealing with the Battle of Midway. We've already got the Naval War College lined up to send someone to talk to us about the recent release of the newly archived version of the Nimitz Gray Book, and we're going to have some other great guests on as well. So please stay with us, and looking forward to going and having you on again on Military Monday. Thank you so much.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. I got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? Saw a man on the TV and a man with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my soul. A song for a dead man, and now I'll never grow old. I wrote a song for a dead man, and now I'm out in the cold. What's a song? Oh,
There's a baby on the doorstep, longing for the day. There's a baby on the doorstep, who gives his life to take. A flare through a pawn shop, a flare through a pawn shop. May he forget why he is crying so dear.